MacCast, Monday, October 16th, 2017. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Looking through the show notes today, we've got probably a little bit of a shorter show on the front end, at least when it comes to the news, but then I've got some great stuff for you in the back half, including an interview. Many of you have been asking me about the new Apple TV 4K, and a lot of questions have been flying back and forth, and I've been wondering a lot of things myself because I'm really not up on the HDTV 4K technologies. But luckily, if you've been listening to this show for a long time, you know that I know somebody who is, and that's Ara Derderian from the HDTV podcast at htguys.com. Well, I rung him up and got him on an interview. We talked a little bit about the new Apple TV 4K. He's had a little bit of time to spend with it, although I think we're going to get him back on for a follow-up. So we went kind of through a lot of the initial questions. I had a lot of questions about content and those sorts of things, and a lot of them were your questions, really. So I had been asked a number of things. We are going to try and answer those questions for you in today's episode. And I also have a great, fun thing of the moment for you. But before all that, we have a little bit of news to get into, so let's just jump right in and start to talk about a few things. Apple released an update for iTunes 12.6.3. Yeah, and you might be thinking right now, didn't iTunes 12.7 come out like a week or so ago? And you'd be absolutely right, right? That was the big one. A lot of us know about iTunes 12.7 because it removed the ability to install apps and ringtones directly from iTunes. You kind of have to do it a little bit differently now. You basically have to drag them onto your device from the Finder. They're not just listed in there anymore. And it also was the big update that removed access to the App Store on the Mac. So you can't go through iTunes into the App Store, at least under 12.7, and just browse around in the App Store, something that I'm particularly frustrated by because that was something I really enjoyed doing. Well, it turns out there's another group of people that likes to be able to install their apps through iTunes and maybe browse around on the iTunes store, and that is Apple's business customers. So they did release an update to iTunes 12.6. 12.6.3 is out, and it works with iOS 11 and the new iPhone 8 and iPhone 8 Plus, which was some of the updates that were put in for 12.7, but it's designed for Apple's business customers who still need to install apps via iTunes. The reality is it's really not just available to business customers. Really, anyone can go to Apple's support website, and I'll have a link to the article in the show notes at maccast.com, and you can install it. Now, according to the Mac Observer, they say you can install iTunes 12.6.3 right over the top of 12.7, but if you do, you are no longer going to get any notifications for future iTunes updates. So you're going to be kind of off on a divergent track at that point, and you're going to have to pay attention. If Apple comes out with new updates to 12.7, you're going to have to download those on your own and then install that over the top, I assume, of 12.6.3. Now, they did say you can just install it right over the top, but Mac Rumors said and mentioned in their piece about the possibility to need to rebuild your iTunes library, basically hold down the Option key at launch, create a brand new library using iTunes 12.6.3, and then use the Add to Library option to basically migrate all of your old files, your audio files and things like that over, which sounds really cumbersome to me. I'm hoping that Mac Observer is right on this one. I am personally sticking with 12.7. I'm moving forward. I'm not planning on going back, but I wanted to bring up this story because I know there's some of you out there who are a little bit frustrated by the 12.7 update. So you do have an option. Just be aware it may be a little bit tricky. It could be totally smooth upgrading, or it might be a little bit tricky. I didn't want to try it myself because I really don't want to find out the latter. So sorry I wasn't the guinea pig on this one, but maybe some of you can be, and you can let me know how that process goes if you do decide to install iTunes 12.6.3. It seems like every time, or at least More recently, every time Apple releases a major update to the operating system, there's this little conspiracy theory that starts to pop up and crop up around our community, and that is that Apple is deliberately slowing down older iPhones with the new operating system, and the rationale behind this is that they do it deliberately to force customers to upgrade to new devices, basically for profit. And I've already actually heard this from several listeners and friends and family out and about saying, hey, yeah, I heard that Apple is deliberately slowing down iPhones to force their customers to upgrade. And the reports you may have heard about more recently were based on increases in Google searches for the term iPhone slow after the iOS 11 release. So the evidence for this conspiracy theory is every time Apple updates the operating system, people start searching for iPhone slow more often, you know, more frequently. And you might be already thinking exactly what I was thinking when I saw this, was that, of course, anytime a new operating system comes out, people are going to be searching for things related to that operating system. And if you feel like your device is slow, or even if it is perceivably slower, that's the term you're going to be searching for. So obviously those are going to go up, but that doesn't directly correlate into any hard evidence that, yes, iPhones or older iPhones are getting slower with a new operating system update. And FutureMark, the benchmarking people who make the benchmarking software, I think they thought kind of the same thing, because they decided, you know what, we have a lot of historical data, benchmarking data on different iPhones running different versions of the operating system. And so we can actually take that data and look at it and see, is this a real thing? We can actually prove, do iPhones get slower when running iOS 11, older iPhones? And guess what they found? Yep, they found out that no, Apple is not deliberately slowing iPhones down. Now, again, that doesn't mean that people aren't experiencing some of that, but in looking at the pure raw data, the pure benchmarks, they looked at a number of different models, everything from the 5S forward running versions of iOS 9, iOS 10, and iOS 11, and they were comparing all of those in both GPU and CPU performance. Again, these are benchmark tests, and what they found overall is that there was almost no variation, or very little variation, a few anomalies here and there, but nothing that couldn't be compensated for within standard deviation. They found no, they're actually running about the same with each release of the OS, from iOS 9 to iOS 10 to iOS 11. And that would make sense, because you have kind of the same processor, but the results definitely showed that there was not deliberate slowing going on. And as a matter of fact, it even showed that Apple seems to have done a pretty good job in actually keeping performance consistent as they upgrade the operating system, which is a hard thing to do. It would make sense that older devices would get slower when you have new technology running on them. Again, now some of the new features, because this is just a benchmarking test, there could be some reasons why certain things run slower. And one of those would be some of the new features actually require more resources and more processing power. So if your phone is doing some of that stuff, I would imagine things like ARKit don't run quite as well on maybe a 5S as they do on an iPhone 7, but that sort of thing's to be expected. You also might have some applications that maybe aren't fully optimized, or were optimized for older devices, but have not been updated for newer versions of the operating system, have not been made to take full advantage of any of the new features and optimizations that, say, iOS 11 brings, and that can cause some slowing. And we do know the whole 32-bit app thing, those were in iOS 11, basically sunsetted, so you can't run those 32-bit apps anymore, but developers were warned about that, and those that chose not to upgrade to 64-bit, those apps no longer run, and we kind of knew that coming into this, but I wanted to talk about this a little bit again, because I've had several people mention this, but there you go. I mean, those are hard facts and numbers that are hard to dispute, right? These guys kind of know what they're doing, and they back up the claim that no, Apple is not slowing down older iPhones. If you want to believe analysts, it's looking more and more like 2018 is going to be the year of Face ID for Apple and most or many of its products. I was going to say most of its products, but many of its products. This information comes from one of our favorite analysts, Ming-Chi Kuo, over at KGI. He says that in 2018, iPad Pros are going to gain Apple's iPhone X True Depth camera system. Now, interestingly, he does think that Apple's going to limit the technology to just the iPad Pros. He says the goal would be to unify the user experience and also help increase developer adoption and support for features in the True Depth camera system, not just Face ID, but also the depth sensing camera technologies as well. And he does still think that Apple has a huge lead, but that Android makers are going to follow that lead and try and bring Face ID or facial recognition technology to their devices and get rid of fingerprint sensors as well. But he does think that Apple has about a 1.5 to 2.5 year head start with the technology. So it's going to be a while before we see it in other devices. Kuo also does believe that Apple is going to ditch Touch ID on all iPhone models in 2018. So I would imagine the iPhone 9, well, we don't really know what it's going to be yet. He thinks that those are going to gain the True Depth camera system and Face ID technology in lieu of Touch ID. And eventually it's looking like Apple will probably ditch Touch ID altogether in all of their products, but that may take a few years longer, at least for the iPads and maybe the iPod Touches and things like that. And part of the reason I think that might take a little bit longer is Apple is still seemingly struggling with that True Depth camera system. It is being still pointed at as a possible cause for shortages in iPhone X production. We're just, a couple weeks away now from pre-orders of iPhone X, and yeah, things just are still looking pretty bleak. They are improving, I guess, a little bit, because we did have one analyst say that yield rates have improved from about 100,000 units per week, 100,000 units per week to about 400,000 units per week. That sounds like a lot, but again, we're just a few short weeks out from Apple actually shipping these things, so they are still expecting pretty big shortages when it comes to the iPhone X. And the Commercial Times actually reported this morning that Foxconn had shipped the first batch of about 46,500 iPhone units to the Netherlands and the United Arab Emirates. Yeah, again, not that many units. Now, when I saw this number, I was a little bit confused. I had to think about it a little bit. I don't think this means that they're only getting 46,500 units in the Netherlands and the United Arab Emirates. I think this is the buildup, right? As they produce phones in the factory, they're getting distributed out to their areas of final destination. So who knows how much each country is going to get in terms of allotment, but that little number each week is possibly going out between now and launch day, and that will represent the sum total of what's available on launch day. We don't know in other countries or what those numbers are actually going to be. All we know at this point is it's going to be small. So you're going to have to get online, pre-order if you want an iPhone X. It is going to be tough. And I fully expect, again, within minutes, we're going to see order dates slip into 2018. It's going to happen pretty quickly. I'm actually really pretty worried about it this year. And, I generally think I could get in and get one so that I have one to talk about and review for you guys. But that might not happen this year. It really is a distinct possibility. I'm going to do my darndest to get my hands on one, but we'll have to see how it goes. And I have had a couple of you ask about doing some coverage of what to do, what's the best way to do pre-orders and stuff like that are. I definitely still think it's using the app. Another couple bits of advice I would give you. One, make sure that you go in and check your credit card and your payment on file with Apple. If you're going to use Apple Pay, which I think is the best way to do it, make sure your cards are registered, that they're all up to date, that you've entered the CVV2 code. If you're using Apple's upgrade program, we don't know if they're going to do this for the iPhone X. They did it for the iPhone 8, where you could get pre-approval because you do have to do a credit check to get that deal going. So they were doing pre-approval about a week before. So as soon as we know that Apple has that available for the iPhone X upgrade, we'll let you know. But if you're on that program, you're going to want to do that, because otherwise you have to, I think, go into the store. That was a big problem that was caused last year. So prep for that. And the other thing is once it's available for you to be able to pick out the model and the options you want in terms of color, storage size. And this may already be available on the App Store. I have not, or the Apple Store app, rather. I haven't looked at this yet. But go in and you can put all those things together, and then you can favorite your model so that on launch day, you can just go in, go straight to the favorites. You don't have to go through all picking all those options. That will slow you down on the way to checkout as well. So you're going to want to make sure your address is all up to date, just that everything is ready to go so it's as seamless as possible. You can hit buy, or actually, you know, hit your favorite, get all the options filled in, hit buy, hit pay with Apple Pay, and you should be in and out within a matter of seconds. That's going to be the fastest way to do that. So hopefully that covers that. I'll try and cover it maybe in a little bit more in depth as we get closer to the launch day. One possible thing that could be happening with the Touch ID sensors, though, or rather the true depth camera system, excuse me, is that it looks like Apple's looking to add some additional suppliers, at least in the future. And one of those may be their camera module supplier, Largon Precision. Their CEO said recently that they want to expand into the 3D sensor market and produce not only lenses, but also the lasers and everything in a single component. So that's not going to happen immediately. I don't expect it to be part of them to be part of the supply chain for the iPhone X, but maybe for these future upgrades with iPad Pros and future iPhones, Apple will be bringing on more suppliers and maybe a more condensed sensor module with everything kind of in one piece, which would help also for space and all the other things that Apple needs to deal with. So as Apple begins this expansion, this move away from Touch ID to Face ID and using the true depth camera system, fully expect them to find multiple suppliers for that technology. And it looks like that process, that search, has already begun. If you heard the episode last time, I think you know that I complained a little bit about Apple's support for Apple Pay at the retail end, at the consumer side of things, basically the last mile of Apple Pay. And I received a number of emails and comments from many of you who agree with me, at least those of you inside who are also with me here in the US. It seems like Apple Pay outside the US is wonderful and great for the most part. I think Australia, you've mentioned you have a few challenges down there in terms of bank support, but we know that was kind of going on before Apple Pay was released. There was the whole issue of Apple wanting to take a certain cut from each transaction from the banks, and down in Australia, the banks get less per transaction than the banks here in the US do, but Apple wanted basically the same amount, I think 15 cents per transaction, but that was going to be a significant portion of what those banks take. So Apple's been struggling with bank support in Australia. They've been struggling here in the United States, getting retailer adoption, and also just with terminals, you know, that support NFC being enabled and turned on at certain retail locations. I think I've mentioned also here, I've had the experience where certain retailers were supporting Apple Pay and then didn't. Two specific ones were Home Depot very early on was able to take Apple Pay and they stopped taking it. And then more recently, Albertsons, which is a grocery store chain, they're owned by Safeway. They had removed their ability to take Apple Pay, although it is coming back. I think there was an announcement a couple weeks ago that Safeway was going to, for all of their grocery stores, add Apple Pay support. And I already heard from one of you that your local Albertsons is now taking Apple Pay. But you know, overall here in the US, we've just been struggling with getting support at the register, at the pump, all different locations. Well, this week, though, we got some good news. If you're a customer of Wells Fargo here in the US, they are adding Apple Pay support to about 5,000 of their ATMs across the US. And I'm guessing outside the US banks, support for NFC and Apple Pay is probably also pretty good. I don't know, though. Is the ATM support in your country? Do they have support for Apple Pay? Here in the US, you're still going to need to input your PIN. I'm not sure exactly why that is. I've also seen that actually at Apple Pay terminals when you use a debit card sometimes with Apple Pay, it still makes you enter your PIN, which is another frustrating thing. And this goes back to some of my things about Apple needing to better educate, I think, the banks and also just retailers and work on the whole process. You know, the promise that we were sold with Apple Pay was sort of, hey, we don't have to enter PINs or credit card numbers or sign for things. And that's not turning out to be the case either. In a lot of cases, we have to sign here in the US, even when using Apple Pay, which doesn't make sense. Again, I know outside the US, because I've heard from so many of you, you don't have this problem. But here, that is the case. And for the ATM support with Wells Fargo, you also need to make sure that you have a Wells Fargo debit card in your Apple Wallet. Now, I'm not certain. I couldn't find any information on this. I don't think that you will be able to use Apple Pay with a non-Wells Fargo card at a Wells Fargo ATM. That may or may not be the case. I'm not sure, but I'm guessing that you do need to have a Wells Fargo card. And Wells Fargo did announce that they're going to add support to the rest of their ATMs by 2019. So it's going to take a while to do the rollout, 5,000 up front, and I think they have another 7,000 for like 13,000 ATMs in the US that will eventually all get Apple Pay support. So that's kind of cool. You'll be able to go to the ATM, tap your Apple Watch rather than getting your ATM card out and withdraw money if you're a Wells Fargo customer. Apparently, Bank of America also started rolling out this at their ATMs last year. If you are a Bank of America customer or a Wells Fargo customer, let us know how this works for you, if it's something that you like or enjoy. I'm with Chase Bank, and we don't have support for this yet. But hopefully, they'll follow Wells Fargo and Bank of America's lead sometime soon. And I'll get Apple Pay support at my ATM. I'm just hoping for broader Apple Pay support across the United States, right? But we'll have to wait and see. I guess it's a long, slow process. Outside the US, you guys have had NFC and contactless payment technologies for a long, long time. And I'm already hearing that a lot of places are moving on beyond NFC and that now, or chip and PIN rather, and that a lot of your payment cards, your credit cards and your debit cards are just getting NFC chips in them. So you can tap to pay with your card as well, which is pretty cool. But yeah, we're a long ways off from that here in the US apparently. So now we may not have broad support for Apple Pay here in the US, but one thing we apparently do have is a lot of Apple products in our houses. CNBC surveyed 800 people across the US and they found that 64% of Americans own at least one Apple product. Now, that's not a huge sample size, but it does offer a 3.5% margin of error, according to the report. So not too bad. I mean, pretty close, we can say probably about 60% of Americans own at least one Apple product. The average number of products was also up by a full Apple product. So last year when they did this survey, it was 1.6 devices on average per American, Apple devices. And now it's up to 2.6 devices per American. And Piper Jaffray did a separate study of teens earlier this year, and they found that 76% of teens actually owned an iPhone in the US, and that was up from 69% the year before. And they noted that 81% of teens said that they planned to buy an iPhone as their next smartphone. So iPhones have always been popular among teens, getting even more popular. And again, more and more devices making their way, or Apple devices rather, making their way into US households. I have to say, we've been wondering what Apple is going to do with their original content offerings. We've been talking a little bit about the Sony executives that Apple's been hiring up. They've been building out this giant sort of dream team for original content creation. They've agreed to invest up to $1 billion in making original content. And we know they'd been shopping around Hollywood looking for projects to invest that money into. Well, it turns out this week, they signed a deal with Steven Spielberg's Amblin Television, and Comcast NBC Universal TV production to create new episodes of the awesome 80s series Amazing Stories. I am super thrilled about this, being a child of the 80s. It was an original program that ran on NBC from 1985 to 1987. They had two seasons. I didn't remember how long it ran for. Actually won 5 Emmy Awards, and it was amazing. I'm actually re-watching these things. If you get the NBC app, they're actually available, at least here in the US. I don't know outside the US, but through the NBC app, you can actually watch the episodes for free, and I'm going back and watching them. You know, they're kind of campy and funny. It was a family program, but they have great talent behind it. It was produced by Kathleen Kennedy, and also had Gary and Penny Marshall involved as directors on a lot of the early episodes. And the music, the theme for Amazing Stories, was actually done by John Williams. So hopefully they can get some of this talent back on the new series with Apple. Certainly, it sounds like they're going to spend about $5 million per episode, so pretty good production value. This is according to the Wall Street Journal. And Apple is reportedly going to make 10 new episodes of the show. Also involved as a showrunner is Brian Fuller of American Gods and Star Trek Discovery. So they are getting some pretty big talent behind it. In case you're not familiar with Amazing Stories, it was basically one of these shows like The Twilight Zone, where each episode is an entirely new story. So there's not like a running theme where one episode leads to another. Each episode is its own self-contained story. They were 30 minutes long, and they covered the range of different topics from, you know, adventures to dramas to sci-fi horror kind of stuff. And it was just fun every week to tune in and kind of get a little bit of a different story. And again, looking even at the old episodes, they had some pretty good production value. So I'm expecting some pretty good things from this new Amazing Stories effort from Apple. We don't know when it's going to come out. We don't know how it's going to be distributed, if it's going to be part of some sort of bigger streaming service, if it's going to be like Planet of the Apes and some of the other content that Apple's been releasing, the concert series and documentaries that they've been doing through Apple Music. I'm hoping it's the latter. I'm hoping it comes as part of my Apple Music subscription, although it feels more like Apple's trying to build some sort of add-on TV subscription program. But again, we don't know at this point. Again, they're investing pretty big money in this, and supposedly they still are looking to get some sort of Game of Thrones level drama show onto the service as well. They do have a nice head start. They've actually been bidding for and going head to head against Netflix and Amazon for a bunch of new shows. They haven't really won too many up until now. I don't know if Amazon or Netflix was bidding on Amazing Stories or if they were only talking to Apple, but again, they're getting pretty serious about this stuff. And we also did get reports this week that Apple's looking to lease about 85,000 square feet of space in Culver City for this new television production effort just around the corner from Beats headquarters. So I would expect we hear more announcements of more kind of content that Apple's putting together. And I'm really looking forward, again, to these new episodes, but more, even more, finding out what Apple is going to end up doing in this space. Hopefully that's something we'll hear about in 2018. A new report claims that Apple is currently working with LG Display on a display for a future iPhone, an OLED display. But the killer new feature here is that it reportedly is a flexible foldable display. How foldable? I don't really know. We've seen some of these in the past. As a matter of fact, I think LG was working on this technology a few years back. And we've also heard that Samsung has already been looking to launch a flexible display phone next year. Apple's reported effort with LG supposedly is not going to happen until maybe 2020, 2021. So they're a ways behind, but that's probably because Apple is probably wanting to do something with the technology that really it isn't capable of doing right now. That would be my guess, is that they want an actual, hey, let's fold this thing completely flat kind of display. And I don't think the current technology is there yet. Maybe Samsung will surprise us, though. I haven't been keeping too much up to date on my foldable OLED technology. But as you may or may not know, Samsung is currently the sole supplier of OLED panels for the iPhone X, and Apple has always been looking to expand and move away from Samsung in a lot of ways. We've also heard reports that they've been considering using Japan Display for future iPhone displays as well. And then finally in the news for this week, a little bit of a scary story, but luckily it looks like this story is only going to be scary for maybe a little bit. What has happened is a researcher has discovered a way to hack the WPA2 encryption system that is used by most of our Wi-Fi devices. You're probably familiar with this if you've ever set up a Wi-Fi router or a Wi-Fi device. You're probably using WPA2. Luckily, this method is not in the wild yet, but I would imagine it will surface pretty quickly now that the information is out. It uses something called a key reinstallation attack, which is actually where it gets its name, K-R-A-C-K for crack. An attacker would actually need to be close to or within range of your Wi-Fi network to issue the attack. But as you imagine, that's not too difficult these days. Just get within range of someone's Wi-Fi or a public Wi-Fi hotspot, and you have a bevy of potential devices, Wi-Fi devices, that you could issue the attack against. And basically, once they have the attack deployed, they can do man-in-the-middle style attacks, even breaking through like SSL encryption to actually potentially steal passwords and logins and stuff like that. Like I said, it sounds pretty nefarious, and it gets even worse when you find out that the only way to fix the vulnerability really is with a new operating system or firmware update on your devices that use Wi-Fi. And you start to think about all the things that use Wi-Fi, and yeah, it gets pretty scary. Now, luckily, according to Rene Ritchie via Twitter, he says that Apple has already told him that they have a patch for crack in iOS, tvOS, watchOS, and macOS, the betas that are out right now and should be coming to you pretty soon. They also have said that airport routers and time capsules do not appear to be vulnerable to the exploit at this point. So that is good news. And we're already starting to see a lot of companies address the exploit and start to push out patches. So Microsoft and Google have both acknowledged the issue, and Microsoft says they're going to release a Windows 10 patch today. And Google has said the Pixel devices will get an update within the next month or so. And again, we've already been seeing a number of router manufacturers and folks push out updates. So expect many, many patches to be coming right now, probably as soon as you hear this podcast, and even more in the future. It sounds like everybody's kind of on top of this one because it is pretty serious, and I think things are going to get patched pretty quickly. But if you have some sort of oddball device or something on the fringe or something like that, you may want to follow up on it, check with the manufacturer, ask them about it, be insistent that they actually patch this thing, because this one's a pretty serious one. So we'll have to just be diligent about it and make sure that we update our devices, and also, you know, tell your friends and family, get them to update, make sure that they're running the latest version of the operating systems and patching their things and stuff like that, which is just in general always good advice. So with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. A couple quick things to follow up on and to talk to you about before we get to my Apple TV 4K interview with Ara. A number of you have asked, because I brought it up, the fact that I was going to switch my iPhone carrier from AT&T to T-Mobile. And many of you have asked, okay, well, how has it gone? You know, you're a couple weeks into it. How is it going? And I have to say that it has gone incredibly well. My experience has been very good. So I'm going to share my experience with you. My experience may not be the same as yours, so don't read this as an endorsement for you to leave AT&T and switch to T-Mobile. I'm just going to share what happened with me and where I'm at. So overall, in my area, my coverage, at least to me, feels about the same. I've had kind of some arguments with my family, though. They don't feel quite the same. They think they're getting a little less coverage, few more dead zones and things like that than maybe they had before. Certainly my house was an LTE dead zone. We had about 4G here, but we could not get an LTE signal to save our lives. And actually the 4G was even pretty weak. So I did call up T-Mobile's support and mentioned it to them. And they said, yeah, they verified, yeah, you've got kind of a weak coverage area in your area. And they sent me out one of their little microcells. In case you don't know what this is a little device you plug into your Wi-Fi network, and it basically sets up an LTE little mini tower in your house and actually covers the surrounding area. And once I installed that, that process was pretty easy. The signal improved immediately. And the way they described it to me is the cell uses your Wi-Fi network to talk back to their main cell tower, and that's how they get you LTE signal. So that's working great, and we've been happy with that. I would say overall, my call quality, at least in my opinion, has gone up with the switch to T-Mobile. And the probably biggest advantage, though, is the savings on my bill. So T-Mobile offers a couple different things. One, the base plans for my family were just cheaper. It was $160 for unlimited everything. That's talk, text, and data. And I think their data cap per line is at 32 gigabytes per month. So they just raised it. I think it was at 23 or something like that. Don't quote me on those numbers, but basically each line has more than enough bandwidth. We're never possibly going to use that. And as a matter of fact, another part of their program that I signed up for on my lines that use less data is they offer kickbacks. If you have lines that use less than 2 gigabytes of data per month, you get a $10 credit per line under 2 gigabytes of data back on your bill. So I took advantage of that. And I have to tell you, my new bill came this month, and with the kickbacks, and all the taxes and everything else, the total was about $140. So that is versus the $217 per month that my bill was with AT&T. So even with some little minor annoyances like LTE at my house not being great, T-Mobile customer service took great care of me, and I've had to call up customer service a couple times, and they have been fabulous and awesome every single time. So overall, I am extremely happy with the switch, especially with the amount of money that I'm saving every month. I mean, basically, it's going to be able to almost cover the cost of my iPhone in a single year just with the savings I'm going to get back on my cell phone bill. I have not had an opportunity or a chance yet to use my mobile hotspot. I haven't had to do that. And a couple people have mentioned that they felt like they were not getting as good data speeds with T-Mobile. I've tested in a couple different areas. Again, at my house, it was pretty bad in terms of data speeds. I think I was only getting, before we got the LTE hotspot, I was only getting about 3 megabits per second down, which was pretty bad with, 4G. But in other areas, I'm getting standard LTE download speeds and upload speeds. So it really varies depending upon what part of town I'm in, how good the signal is. But again, overall, I haven't noticed any difference. And really, the measure that I have is, if I'm out, can I surf the web? Can I get my texts? Can I get my email? Can I stream video and stuff like that when I want to? And all of that has felt to me about the same as it was with AT&T. You know, once in a while I'd have bad signals and bad coverage, and sometimes it's good and sometimes it's not so good. It's like typical cell coverage stuff. So you put those things together, and the fact that I feel like I'm having the same mobile experience, I stream all my podcasts, I listen to Apple Music, that all works flawlessly, it works great. So again, overall, I'm very, very happy. And I have to tell you, when I announced my switch, I heard from many, many people who made the switch to T-Mobile, and almost universally, you've said to me that you were happy with the switch as well. And I've heard very few people say, I really love AT&T. You should stick with AT&T. I think AT&T is great. Now, maybe some of you are out there, and maybe now that I've said that, we'll hear from some of you. But overall, I just was not happy with AT&T, and overall, my AT&T service was degrading. It was declining. It was great at one point. I was perfectly happy with them 2 years ago, even paying the higher rate, because the service was good, but the service just degraded, and the only theory that I have for that is that they haven't been able to keep up their network with the amount of growth of new devices and phones. More and more people are getting smartphones, more and more people are getting data plans, and I think all of the networks are dealing with oversaturation, and at this point, it just feels like T-Mobile has probably invested the most money in building out their network, and I think it's paying off for them. So that's how I kind of feel about it. Again, I'm always open and welcome to your comments and what you think. So shoot us some feedback, maccast@gmail.com. All right, one more thing before we get into the interview with Ara. And then after the interview, I'm going to have a great thing of the moment for you. So stay tuned for that. But a little quick tip for you. This came from the Mac Observer, something I missed, I guess. This was announced during the Worldwide Developer Conference keynote for iOS 11, but I totally missed it. Apparently, you can now use the camera app built into your iPhone to scan QR codes. All you have to do is double check that it's turned on. I think it's actually turned on by default, but double check it. Go into settings on your iPhone, go into camera if you're running iOS 11, and make sure the scan QR codes option is enabled. And then if that is enabled and you come across a QR code, all you have to do is launch the camera app, point it at the QR code, and bam, it will work. So if you get, if you scan one that takes you to a website, you'll get this little banner that'll pop up when you point the camera at the QR code. It'll say, hey, this is a QR code. I want to take you to this website. Do you want to go there? And you say, okay, and boom, it'll take you to the website or do whatever that QR code is designed to do. Launch an app, whatever it might be. So I thought that was pretty cool, and it means I don't have to have a separate QR code scanning app on my iPhone anymore. In case you're wondering, the one that I did like was simply called Scan, which was a great app, but unfortunately I think that thing just got Sherlocked, at least on my iOS device. All right, let's not take any further time. I want to get into the Apple TV 4K with Ara Dirdirian. So here's Ara and I talking about exactly that.
Hi, Ara, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Nice to be back.
Yeah, it's been a while. We need to get you on more frequently. I know I always say that, but, you know, just time goes by so quickly. And, you know, depending upon what Apple's doing and what's going on, you know, it seems like, especially with something like Apple TV, which we're going to be talking about today, it's few and far between those updates.
Yeah, and you know what? They had a pretty cool update to HomeKit as well, so maybe we can talk about that sometime in the future.
Yeah, absolutely. But I wanted to get you on this time around because, hey, we have a brand new Apple TV, and more importantly, it's really targeting, I think, the high-end consumer for Apple TVs. For example, I'm not really interested in it because I'm not looking for a new TV set anytime soon, and I don't have 4K. But I know there's a lot of people out there that have been chomping at the bit to get a 4K Apple TV, and now we have it. But what I started noticing was I think there's a lot of confusion about how certain things work. You know, because it wasn't just 4K technology, right? They threw in a bunch of other technologies, including HDR and some new audio formats and all those sorts of things. So I knew you were the perfect guy to get on to help explain this stuff to me and my audience, because frankly, I don't understand any of it. And it just is, it flies over my head. It's not the world that I live in. I don't live in this video world. And I know you're into this stuff. So
yeah, sure. No problem. I'll do my best.
Hoping you can help me out with this.
Yeah.
So I guess probably the place to start maybe is just breaking down kind of the basic stuff for people. You know, I know 4K means more resolution, but beyond that, is there anything else I really need to know about 4K?
Sure. Now, 4K resolution is the third, I think, most important specification. So a lot of people get all hung up on 4K. Oh, I want 4K because the resolution is so much better. Well, the problem with 4K is you need a very large television so you can see the difference. And what we're talking about is, to be honest with you, 75 and larger, although some people can make an argument that at 60 it makes a difference, but if you're sitting pretty close. So when I see 4K on like a 40-inch or 50-inch TV, it's kind of pointless.
Mm-hmm.
So
why is that?
Because to be able to see the difference between 4K and 1080p mm-hmm. on a 50-inch screen, you have to be sitting about 3 to 4 feet away from the screen.
Hmm.
And it just your eye. If you think about it, look at a really lousy YouTube video on your laptop and look at it while you're sitting really close to it and then step back. And the further back you step, the less bad it looks, right?
Sure.
Because you can't see the issues, the compression issues or anything like that. Well, same is true with resolution. The further back you sit, the less your eye can make out the difference.
Right. So you're saying because there's because the pixels start blurring together as you move further away, it doesn't really matter if you have more pixels. Is that the concept?
That's exactly right.
Okay. Okay. So, because it's really a quadrupling of the resolution, essentially, of a 1080p image, right? I mean, because you've got double in both directions. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
And so, but the big, I think, thing that comes with this new Apple TV is the HDR support, and that's high dynamic range. Mm-hmm. And what that does is it gives you a lot better contrast. And contrast is, I believe, the second most important, or it could be the first, but it's either contrast or color. And color, if you were to take a 1080p television with the wider color gamut that's associated with the newer televisions mm-hmm. and HDR, and I showed you a 1080p picture, you would think, oh, man, I'm looking at 4K. So that's the bigger news here is the HDR support.
Okay, but HDR is not something that's exclusive to 4K. Like, can I get a 1080p set that does HDR and wide?
Well, it's only exclusive color? Because they're only building TVs with 4K resolution that support it.
Okay.
There's nothing that stops them from putting it in 1080p, but I think the reason they don't is for what I just said. People will look at that and say, wow, this looks great, and they don't want to pay the premium. So you've got 4K and everyone's thinking, oh, that's a cool thing and I want to pay. And a lot of people, myself included, and I knew what I was doing when I did this, by the way, went out and bought 4K TVs when they first came out that didn't support HDR or the wider color gamut. And there was only a marginal improvement at that point. Okay. So now when you're looking for a television, a 4K television, make sure it supports HDR. And there's two types. There's HDR10 and Dolby Vision. And so I believe Dolby Vision is probably more important because I think more studios are going to support that. That's just my opinion. That's not based on any fact or anything,
right,
other than my opinion. And
they tend to like that Dolby word, right?
Exactly. And that's why I think that's the case. And the other thing is the Dolby Vision is compatible with the new HDR 2.0 HDMI 2.0 cable. So there's another reason why I think that'll do well. But so you want to get a TV with HDR and the wider color gamut.
Okay. So when you're looking at TVs, those are the two things that you want to be kind of looking at. And I think it's important to kind of note that as well. Like, is there, besides future proofing? So I know a question I've been getting a lot is, hey, I have a 1080p, you know, I have an Apple TV 3. Do I need an Apple TV 4 if I don't have an HDR? You know, if I don't have a 4K set, is there any advantage to getting an Apple TV if you don't have a 4K TV?
Well, you mean if you've got an Apple TV 4, there's right. No advantage if you don't have a 4K TV. If you have an Apple TV 3, then you know, you get the benefits of having
sure,
an Apple
the, TV 4. The new yeah. Apple TV features.
But I agree. In your situation, like you just described, since you do not have a 4K TV, there'd be no advantage to you. Other than maybe if
like
you're a gamer or something.
Or, you know, like,
no, if you're a gamer or something. You know, I believe it has more processing power, so it has better gaming.
Sure.
But if you're pretty much using it for watching television and movies, I don't see any advantage.
All right. So let's talk a little bit. Another thing that has caused a lot of confusion, I think, since the 4K Apple TV came out is content. Right? Because Apple says, okay, we're going to have a bunch of 4K. We're going to have a bunch of our movies at 4K. And good news, hey, they're going to be the same price as your HD. And if you got HD movies with us, we're going to let you upgrade to 4K for free. You know, we're not going to recharge you. You don't have to buy a new 4K formatted version. And everybody went, oh, yay, that's awesome. But it sounds like that came with some caveats.
What caveats? I wasn't aware because I thought that was
One of the caveats
cool.
is streaming only.
Oh yeah, I see. Yeah, that's true.
So you cannot download your 4K content onto your Apple TV or onto your Mac. And where that becomes a concern, I think, is, and maybe we can talk about this a little bit. And this came up actually when we talked about HD and things like that too. Bandwidth and bandwidth caps and data rates, right? And download speeds. For example, I think Apple says a minimum, you know, internet connection, if you want to watch their 4K content, at least through iTunes, they're recommending that you at least have 25 megabits per second in terms of your download to be able to actually stream the 4K content. So is all 4K content streaming wise created equal, or are we still in this scenario where, you know, cable companies are really compressing it down to get data bit rates down and sort of, you know, crunching it, do you know?
Well, if you're streaming from Apple, the cable companies have nothing to do with
that.
But you're talking about watching 4K, like, say, on your satellite dish or something?
So, again, is all 4K content created equal? And I think the answer is no, a lot of it isn't.
As far as the term of compression, that's the key differentiator there. You can, in fact, the funny thing is, Amazon Netflix has 4K content, and they can put it in a pretty small pipe. When I say small, we're talking like 8 to 12 megabits per second,
right?
But it's highly compressed, and it doesn't look as good as Apple's, which I don't know about 25 megabits per second. I was watching some stuff over the weekend, and I don't have a very high speed internet because I have a business account, mm-hmm. and it just costs too much money. So I don't have caps, but as a result, I only have 39 megabits per second. So I was streaming with no problem, and people were using the internet in the house at the same time without it affecting anybody. So it could be, but I think if you've got high speed internet, you're probably okay. If you live in an area that still has DSL or maybe out in some rural areas, it may not work for you.
Okay. Yeah. And so another area that I'm hearing about content wise that people might want to be aware of. And again, a lot of this is with Apple's content that they're pushing out to consumers that was already in the iTunes store and was not 4K. It was HD content. And now they're pushing out 4K. Is that a lot of that stuff is remastered, but it has to be remastered and upscaled from really HD content because it was never shot in 4K. So well, yeah, there's a big difference there too, right?
Yes, if it wasn't shot in 4K, then yeah, it's being upscaled, but it's still an improvement. So that's the thing. And I looked at some, I tried to do side by side comparisons, and I mean when I went up really close. The problem was I couldn't get side by side on the same screen. So it was kind of like you watch it, then you go back and you tried to stream the other one. And unless you, so it's not really side by side.
You have to have like a good visual memory. But yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. But it's the best we can do.
I didn't notice that it was any significantly better or worse. But, you know, I guess they're saying it's 4K. So I agree with you. Upscaled 4K. If anything, is marginally better, but what you want is the true mastered in 4K and HDR.
Right, and that's going to be your newer movies that sort of have to be shot in that. I would imagine, again, just like you were saying earlier, though, the HDR
The newer movies, we're talking going back like 3 or 4 years. They've been shooting stuff in 4K for quite some time.
Well, and again, I can't remember specific titles, but I know I've been told, you know, it just varies from studio to studio and depending upon what the film was and sort of maybe what the film's budget was. And I mean, there's even modern stuff, as far as I know, that's not necessarily being mastered or shot original in 4K. So, you know, it's just one of these things that people have to think about. And I guess that's what I'm sort of responding to. Like, everybody was clamoring for this 4K thing, and everybody was saying, well, Apple's so far behind and not having a 4K Apple TV, and everybody else has 4K. But I think the content still seems like it's in its infancy in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and that's a good point. That's why when Apple didn't come out with a 4K, there were a lot of people, I remember, saying, what a dumb move. And I didn't care because I knew the 4K content that I was watching on my Fire TV didn't seem that great, let's be honest. It looked good, but nothing that great. It wasn't until the HDR came out that made things a lot better. And even there's not that much HDR available. So your assessment is correct. We're in the infancy of a 4K and HDR. So if you don't have it now, it's not going to hurt you to wait a few more years. If you do have a 4K HDR TV and you get it, you know, if you bought the Apple TV 4 and now you're going to have to upgrade, that's kind of maybe that was Apple's plan all along. It's like, you know, we'll string them along for a couple of years and some of the people will buy another device. I know I was stupid enough to do it. So.
Right. And then I guess the other thing that some people are complaining about is YouTube content not being available in 4K HDR, and it may never be available. And it comes down to a codec issue. So Apple, and I think most people are using the new H.265 HEVC codecs for that. But I guess YouTube uses that proprietary, I'm going to forget the, it's like P9 or something like that,
yes.
Right?
And that is true. And I went and looked at something that was 4K on YouTube. And obviously it wasn't 4K what I was watching, but it still looked pretty damn good. So again, 4K is not the end all. It's because it's just resolution. Mm-hmm. And again, if you've got a 55-inch screen, you got to sit really close to see the difference. So I don't feel that that's that big a deal. It's when you get into the wide color gamut and the HDR that you start seeing a lot of difference. But I will make this comment. The studios are just now trying to figure out how to use that. Because if you think about it, in the early days of HD, some of the content looked great and some of it didn't look that good at all until they kind of got their workflow down. And I think that's where we are too. We're probably a year away from getting consistently high quality HDR content.
All right. So I want to talk to you about all the variables that seem to go into setting up the hardware. So, okay, let's say this is great. I go out and I get a 4K TV. I get a 4K TV that does HDR. It does Dolby Vision. Maybe it also do a lot of them do both the Dolby Vision and the HDR 10.
Yes.
Is that pretty common? So, you know, I get both things.
Now it is, yeah.
Okay, so I get both of those. So I've got my TV. I got my new 4K Apple TV. I'm going to go hook it up now. Maybe I have a stereo component system with a switcher that runs through that. It seems like there's a lot of confusion about how to hook things up, how to configure things. And I'm getting a lot of people saying, hey, it's not doing auto switching when 4K comes on or Dolby Vision comes on. What is that all about? Because I'm really confused by that.
Okay, so you're right. So you take your Apple TV, and if you go directly to your 4K television that has HDR, you're good. You'll be able to get the appropriate signal to the television, and it will do what it's supposed to do. If you run it through a receiver, like a lot of people do to get the surround and that kind of thing, you have to make sure your receiver will support that and pass that information up to the TV. So you need a television that supports HDCP 2.2 and HDMI 2.0. And if your receiver supports that, then your chain, your audio video chain will work, and all the information should get passed up to the TV, and you should be watching 4K HDR content.
Okay. What about the whole switching thing? Because I've been hearing people say that they have to go in and manually tell their TV, hey, I have HDR content coming into you, you know, like it defaults to SDR, standard resolution.
So some TVs will do that. Some TVs require you to use a specific input. Some receivers require to use a specific input. For instance, I have a Yamaha receiver, and I need to have my 4K content on HDMI 1, 2, or 3. If I were to put it on HDMI 4, 5, or 6, I'm not going to get 4K content. So you need to look at your television and your receiver to make sure you're using the appropriate inputs and enabling HDR, because some of the TVs won't automatically enable it.
Okay. But I mean, so if you are hooked up right and you have the right kind of set and stuff like that, you pay attention to this stuff ahead of time, then a lot of this stuff should be working. So is some of the complaining, some of the things that people are running into, just them not understanding, in your opinion, how to hook things up right? Like, should it auto switch?
You know, it should. But again, when these TVs first come out, the manufacturers are on the leading edge of it too. And so they don't quite, everything's not quite worked out yet. And as things work out, for instance, the metadata that goes along with the signal, maybe they hadn't ratified it. I'm just spitballing here.
Sure.
Perhaps they didn't ratify the specification. So the TV manufacturer said, well, I want to say I've got HDR. So we've got that supported, but we won't auto switch. Okay. And then eventually it all works. If you remember in the early days of HD, a lot of content wouldn't come across because the handshake between the components didn't work. And that was because specific television companies and receivers or whatever, they didn't quite have it working properly, and it was a mess. And sometimes you'd have to turn everything on and off again to get it to work. And that's kind of where we were early on with this as well.
Right. But I would imagine that kind of thing should be getting better at this point.
It will. Now, if your television has a firmware upgrade, if all your components have a firmware upgrade, I would run that, get the upgrade in there, so then these are the types of things that they can fix.
Right. That's actually really good advice. So another parameter that I actually encountered when I went to check this out at the Apple store, and it's been thrown around and I've been asked about it too, is how does refresh rate play into this? Because I noticed, like, when I went into the configuration settings on the Apple TV 4K in the Apple store, Well, the first thing I immediately noticed was, one, it was odd. I went in there and it was set to SDR, and I thought that was strange. And then it had some ability to change the output to HDR, which I did, but I also noticed it offered like 60 hertz refresh rates or 30 hertz refresh rates or 24 hertz refresh rates, and I wasn't really sure what to pick, so I was just kind of messing around with it. Threw it into HDR, I think at 60 hertz. It took a second, went black, refreshed, came back up, and it just looked like crud. And I later kind of discovered that I think Apple was not, they didn't upgrade their TVs, even though they had new 4K Apple TVs. Mm-hmm. They were hooked to old 1080p SDR sets. So that's what caused that problem. But it did make me notice that, okay, again, when you're kind of setting it up, it seems like there's a bunch of options in terms of refresh rate. Is there one that's better than another? Can you kind of find the right one you like, or is there recommendations for, you know, that?
The if it were me, I would put it on, if my television supported it, 4K HDR 60 hertz. Okay. So that's going to get you one frame per second. Even though film is shot at 24 frames per second, there's still live television and that kind of stuff that comes in at 60 frames a second. So okay, that's going to get you very smooth video. I tried the 20, but by the way, when I did it in my house, my television doesn't support it because, like you said, mine went black and nothing ever came up. It just defaulted back to the screen. So then I went to 4K SDR 30 hertz and everything worked fine, and that's where it sits today. So I'm getting 4K at 30 frames per second, and then the television is putting it in at 60, of course. Now, I tried the 24 frames per second, and the menuing just seems sluggish. And I don't know. I have to assume that was Apple.
Apple's
and that
was menuing?
Yes. Okay. It just seems sluggish because it's only 24 frames a second. So sure, how smooth can it be, right?
Right.
But the content that I was watching looked fine. It looked really good, actually. So if you're going to go watch a 24 frame per second movie, it looks really good.
So you may want to switch it in that kind of scenario.
Well, you know what? Then I went back to 30, and I'm like, okay, this still looks okay, too. So there's certain people who have an eye that can see judder and this kind of stuff, mm-hmm. and that's, in my mind, a blessing and a curse because you've got a very good eye, and you can see these great things, but also little things that irritate you, too. My opinion is put it on, if you've got HDR, put it on HDR, and then try the 60 hertz. If it works, you're done. If it doesn't work, then drop it down to 30 hertz.
Okay. So there shouldn't be too much complexity there, then, it sounds
no.
like.
But now, of course, if you're a videophile, you're going to set it to what you want, what you think looks best, and my advice will probably be ignored, which is fine.
Right.
But there's a lot of, and I'll be honest with you, if you're a videophile, you're watching ultra-high definition discs. You're not actually going to stream it.
Right. Fair point. Okay. So I think that kind of takes care of a lot of the technical sort of ins and outs that I had. I think last thing I just want to talk to you about is I think you do have a 4K Apple TV. So what's your just general impressions of the update and the experience and that stuff? I know the hardware hasn't changed too much. I guess there's a little thing with the remote, but you know, what's your overall opinion about what Apple has put together in terms of a 4K Apple TV?
So I like it as a platform for content that is yet to come. That's probably the best way to describe it.
Yeah.
Because it's really going to sing when you get really high quality content. And while there's a couple things in there, I watched Logan, and that was UHD, HDR. It looked really good. And then I popped in the UHD disc that I have of that. And I still think that looked better. But I'll tell you, to be honest with you, if I was sitting at home on a Saturday night and I didn't have the disc and I said, oh, let me go check out this movie, I would not be disappointed with it whatsoever. I would look at it and go, gosh, this looks pretty good. Right. So it's a great place where we're at right now with content and being able to watch the stuff from your living room, not having to go to, you know, even Redbox or anything like that. We've come such a long way. Again, I buy a lot of discs that I watch upstairs in my media room, which is which is still 1080p. My 4K is on the 70-inch screen, and I'll be honest with you, I would still prefer to watch Blu-ray on a 100-inch screen because, of course, I've got a better sound system up there too. So it's just one part of the entire puzzle. So that's, I guess, how to look at it.
Right. I guess there are, I just remembered, there are two other technical things that I forgot to ask you about. I know there's been some controversy or some people whining about upscalers and just confusion over, hey, my TV has an upscaler. I don't know if some receivers have upscalers. The Apple TV itself has an upscaler. So how do you figure out or determine or decide, you know, which upscaler to use?
Well, if you've set your Apple TV to 4K, it's going to do the upscaling. So your TV is going to see a 4K picture, and it's just going to put the screen, the picture that comes in on the screen. There's no reason for it to upconvert. If you've got a 4K TV and you've got the old Apple TV, it's setting out a 1080p, and then the TV will upconvert it to 4K. So that's essentially how that works.
Okay, so there's not a setting or anything. It just goes, the TV just goes, okay, I'm getting a 4K signal.
Exactly.
I'll accept that. And since the Apple TV is always sending out a 4K signal, regardless of what the source content is, because it has a built-in upscaler, then it's just doing its thing. I guess some people were complaining that, hey, what if I want to use this other upscaler that I have? I guess it would be mainly for people who have really high-end TVs or something like that.
Well,
and they feel like their upscaler is better than Apple's.
If you're using that upscaler, then you're talking about content that's not 4K, right? So it's only going to be, say, Hulu or something along those lines. And at that point, the quality that coming in is decent, but not that great. Anyway, either upscaler is going to work.
Is there a way to disable Apple's one, though? I think that was maybe part of the complaint.
Oh, yeah. Well, send it a 1080p signal. You can go back and say send 1080p.
Oh, you can. Okay.
Yeah. So if for whatever reason you're watching 1080p content and you don't want Apple to upconvert it, just go back into the video settings, set it to 1080p, and then it'll send a 1080p signal to the to your television, and your television
can. So you can't override it. It's just somewhat inconvenient because you're having to go.
Yeah, you're not going to do it on
settings
a,
back and forth.
An application basis. You're going to do it on a. Well, now I'm going to do it this way. And I'll be honest with you, the Apple's got a pretty decent processor in there. I think the upscaling is going to be sufficient, short of somebody having a professional upscaling product.
Right, so some sort of external box that they're running everything through that's dedicated to doing upscaling of content. Yeah, I mean, I've always seen the Apple TV as more of a consumer level product. Like you're saying, like I think people who are really into the stuff, they're going to be using discs and not streaming because of the whole bitrate thing and all of that sort of stuff, right?
Yeah, definitely. I would be surprised of any video file telling you that the quality of the Apple TV 4K content is superb.
No, I haven't been hearing that either. But just sometimes they'll point to other boxes like Roku's or stuff like that and try and imply that they're better.
It could be, but it would just be marginally better. They're all going to suffer from the same compression issues with the data rate. Now, if Apple decided for whatever reason to send you a 50 megabit per second signal, now you're talking, you may be in the same category as the discs. So, and that could be coming down the road, but think about how much data you're going to use for that kind of thing.
Right. I guess the only other limitation or technical thing that we haven't touched on is audio. What's your thought on audio, and more specifically the fact that it doesn't have the Dolby Atmos, at least not yet?
So, yeah, the audio is the same as far as Dolby Digital. I wish they would do Dolby Digital Plus. I didn't see that anywhere. And I definitely hear a difference on the Apple TV when I'm watching something with Dolby Digital Plus than I am with Dolby Digital. So that would be an advancement that they
can
do.
What's the advantage of Plus over Dolby Digital? Well, what does it bring to the table?
It's a better compression algorithm than what they're using on Dolby Digital. And so you just get a higher quality. If you've heard of like Dolby True HD or DTS Master HD, Dolby Digital Plus, most experts have compared it to on par with Dolby True HD, but it is compressed. It's just a better compression algorithm.
Okay.
So we don't have that. Now, Atmos, I get a lot of slack for this because my opinion on Atmos is if you're in a family room, Atmos is overkill. If you've got a 7.1 system in a typical size family room, there's already so much effects going on. Having something in the ceiling in between your front and rear, I don't think adds that much more. Now, if you've got a, that's just my opinion.
No, I'm laughing because I'm thinking about my own scenario. You know, my living room from the TV to the couch, you're talking, I'd be shocked if it was more than 8 feet.
Yeah, you know? So for you, it could make a little bit difference. But one movie that I recall that I was demoing Atmos in my theater was what was that movie Earthquake with The Rock? San Andreas.
Oh, yeah, San Andreas.
There was so much stuff going on. I couldn't. There was things in the rear and the back rear and the front and everything, and I couldn't hear any Atmos. But there was another movie that had like a demo of Atmos, and it had like feet like in your attic, and that I could hear, and it sounded pretty darn cool. But the problem is it was isolated. But once you bring in all the other effects, it's hard to pinpoint it. So I wasn't that impressed with it. Now, go into a big movie theater where you've got a lot of space, and right. I think there you get the benefit. So my opinion on that is, again, if you are using your Apple TV in a typical family room, it's not a loss. Now, if you've got a dedicated theater that's decent size and you still want to use your Apple TV, that's kind of a bummer then, because Atmos would give you something in that environment.
Okay. Yeah. But, luckily, Apple has already come out and said, yes, we'll be adding that at some point in the future. They haven't said when, but it is coming. But it was just something people immediately knocked on the Apple TV for, because, again, it's a higher price point product at $179, $199 versus some of the other streaming boxes that are out there, like the Fire TV or the Roku, which both, I guess, currently do support Atmos.
I'll tell you, Apple did two big things, I think, here to try to help sell that box a little more. One, getting Vudu on there, and then two, with the eventual addition of Amazon Prime Video. That is the only reason I have my Fire TV, is because I watch Prime Video, some content that they have on there. Right. If I could get that on my Apple TV, there's no reason to.
Where is that?
Yeah, that's coming. I do believe it's coming.
They've said it. They said it will before the end of the year sometime. So, but it's okay. It's amazing. Well, it's taking them so long. I mean, they officially announced it at Worldwide Developer Conference. Hey, they had Amazon out there saying we're bringing it to Apple TV. And I think a lot of people were expecting it to come out with the 4K Apple TV. And when it didn't, it was just sort of like, what is going on? Why is this taking such a long time to get this deal done?
Well, so it will get done, and I think that is another good reason to have it, because other than the Prime Videos, I'm trying to do, and of course they do have Dolby Digital Plus, which is pretty cool. There's no reason to have the Fire TV. Roku's got its own thing that has benefits that Apple doesn't have, and there's some Chromecast stuff that, I guess, it's smaller. I'm not a big fan of the Chromecast stuff. But the Fire TV, I think, they're trying to make money with that and tie it in with Alexa. And so I'm surprised that they actually gave in and put the Apple, put their videos on Apple, because now they're actually selling Apple TVs again on Amazon. I guess that was right. A deal that they had to strike. So,
yep. okay. So I'm going to put you on the spot, and then I'm going to let you go, because I know you're a big Apple guy like I am. Mm-hmm. Right. And so there may be some bias in here, but
plenty of bias.
if you were to try to take bias out of it, there's a lot of 4K, TV set top box offerings out there. We've mentioned a few of them. Who do you think the Apple TV is really for, and which would you be recommending to, which box would you be recommending to most people? Is it the Apple TV? And if it is, why? And if it isn't, why not?
So Apple TV is purely for, in my mind, the people who are in the Apple ecosystem. As simple as that. The if you want, and likewise, I think the Fire TVs for the people in the Amazon ecosystem. The if you wanted a set-top box, and let's say you wanted to be completely agnostic, I'd say get a Roku. That pretty much does what either one of those does, and is not tied to either ecosystem. You can buy your content on the Roku, and so it's a good box. It's cheaper, but if you you know, if you're listening to your podcast, you're definitely an Apple fan.
Right.
There's no reason to look otherwise other than Apple. Now, I'll say this, too. I love the interface of the Apple TV. And the TV app that they have on Apple is, I think, a pretty cool deal, because it aggregates all the shows that you watch into one app, which I really like. Because when a new show comes up, I go, oh, there's a new show that I've been watching, and that's on my Sci-Fi app. There's one that's on the CBS app. So that is actually really cool.
Yeah, I love that. I love that feature, at least for the stuff that's integrating with it. I'm praying beyond all get out that Amazon taps into that, whether they do or not. I really wish
That would be great.
Netflix
because, like,
would jump on board, but I don't think they ever will, unfortunately.
Yeah, I wish Netflix would too. But, you know, the cool thing is, like, if a new episode of, like, The Grand Tour comes on, it just shows up in there. That would be excellent.
Yeah, yeah. So I think I really agree with you. You know, I think if you are outside the Apple ecosystem, I'm not sure. I think I'd even personally have a hard time recommending with the price point and knowing the competitive boxes that are out there, recommending an Apple TV. But again, for me, I don't, almost all my content, especially my purchased movies, are all coming through iTunes. And so at that point, there's really no other choice, right? Because
and I'll tell you,
you're not going to get to watch your Apple, iTunes purchased content on your Roku.
And a thing that kind of rubs me the wrong way right now is there's some discs that I buy that don't have an iTunes component for the digital download.
Right.
Because sometimes it's nice that I'm able to download it to my tablet and watch it on the road. But with Vudu, I think Vudu supports Ultraviolet, because all the ones that don't support iTunes are supported in Ultraviolet. So I think the Vudu app, if you create an Ultraviolet locker, now you'll be able to, between the two, get all your content.
That's good. So, there's no Ultraviolet app for Apple TV, huh?
You know what? I haven't looked, but I don't recall there being one.
I just remember it being a horrible experience when I tried to use that app. iOS app, and it was just, like, terrible.
It's gotten much better. But yeah, Vudu is the way to go.
Okay, so if you're dealing with that content, check out Vudu. Well, cool. I think, unless you have anything else to add, that answers a lot of my questions, and hopefully answers a lot of the listeners' questions as well. But
sure. And if anyone has any questions, they can feel free to send me an email. My email is ara@htguys.com.
Yep. And you've been on the MacCast many times in the past. New listeners, though, may not be familiar with you and your show and stuff like that. You want to tell them sort of what you do outside of coming and being a guest on the MacCast and
where they can find all that stuff?
Sorry.
Yeah, sure. I, along with my co-host, Braden Russell, we put out the HDTV and Home Theater podcast. It comes out weekly on Friday morning. And we talk about, obviously, HDTVs, home theater, but we've expanded to include home automation, sometimes just home technology. We've talked about security cameras, but the main part of it is home theater and HDTV. We'll talk about television shows. So it's stuff that you would pretty much have in your house, and we talk about it. Some people have said HT guys should stand for home tech guys instead of home.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, well, it works, so I'm good with it.
Maybe branch out. And I'll just throw out that Ara, I have known Ara for a long, long time, and that's because you're like me. You're one of the original podcasters from way back when.
So yours was the first podcast I downloaded, and I'll never forget. I was listening to you on speakers, and my wife's like, "Who's that? And why is he talking to you about the Macintosh?" And I said, "That's a podcast." And I remember she's thinking, "What is a podcast?" Now she listens to her own. But yeah, that goes back many, many years. And just randomly, I ran into you at the first podcast show up in Ontario, California. Just we were like two people behind each other in line, and I saw your name tag said MacCast. I go, "Hey, I've been listening to you for a long time." So it was kind of cool.
Yep. So original podcaster. So it's a great show, been around for years and years. And so if you're into that in any way, shape, or form, check it out. Thanks, Ara. I really appreciate you coming on and helping out. And we're going to get you back because I think you mentioned you have another, your HD sets in another place. So once you've had a little more time to spend.
Oh, yeah.
I know this is early HDR. Days.
Yeah, yeah, so I've been watching a lot of non-HDR content, but we could also talk about the HomeKit because there's a lot of really cool things in there and a couple of things I'd like Apple to add, and we could talk about that.
Okay, well, yeah, we'll get you on for some home automation stuff because there's always questions around that. So if you have a question around home automation and HomeKit, start sending those in and we'll just make up a list, and then maybe in a couple weeks or something we can get you back on and we'll do that. So thanks,
Sounds Ara. Good. All right, my pleasure.
So there you go, Ara Derderian from the HT Guys. Check out his podcast. And again, we'll get him back on here pretty soon to talk about home automation and stuff like that. A couple other things related to Apple TV that happened this week, or really one other thing that I wanted to mention, is there is a really cool service from Disney called Disney Anywhere, Disney Movies Anywhere, something like that. If you have Disney movie content or you've purchased Disney movie content, maybe you know about this service. Basically, it allowed you to log in with your Disney account and then attach it to any place where you may have bought Disney movies, and it would consolidate those movies and make them available across all of the services. And it was really great. It was a service that I used, but it was just limited to Disney movies. Well, this week, it was announced that a number of the major studios, actually most of them, at least here in the U.S., have gotten together, and they now simply have created a service called Movies Anywhere. And this includes the Disney movies. So that's been rolled into that service. And it is awesome. I just have to tell you, I'm super excited about it because it means now that I am not restricted to just buying my movies from iTunes. I can now have the option, if Amazon has a better deal on the movie because they're part of the service and so is Google, I can buy in the movie wherever I want, and then that movie will be added to my Movies Anywhere account and put into that library, and that library then syncs over with iTunes. So now I can watch that movie on my Apple TV through iTunes, wherever else I want to interact with that movie, even though I purchased it on another service. So it's like digital unlocking across all of the services and all of your devices. And they do have an app available so you can kind of manage and look at that stuff. But ultimately, really for me, because I'm an Apple guy, I just want everything in my Apple library. And this totally enables that. And plus, there's also another cool little trick. If you have physical media, old physical media, there's something you can do with that too. I'm going to talk about this a little bit on the back end, but basically, listener Ty sent in this audio comment with his feelings about Movies Anywhere and this cool little tip. So here's Ty.
Hey, Adam, this is Ty from Virginia. Just wanted to let you know about my experience with Movies Anywhere. It used to be Disney Movies Anywhere, but now Disney and Fox and Sony and I'm not sure who else have gotten together and have made this app to where you could access all your movies on iTunes, Amazon, Vudu, and Google Play. So I had a lot of movies on iTunes, of course, and I kind of supplemented on Vudu because of the disc to digital, where you could get 10 movies for $10 by taking your Blu-rays and scanning them into the computer, and the computer would actually verify that it was a real it was your movie, and then you would get the digital copy on Vudu. So as I did that, I kind of just had some movies on Vudu, some on iTunes, and so kind of it was a, you know, fragmented system, but it worked. And so now they've come together, and now I, you know, this morning 100+ movies just popped into my iTunes after I synced all my or linked all my accounts through the Movie Anywhere website. I also downloaded the app onto my iPhone and onto my Apple TV, and this is a thing of beauty. This is exactly what I wanted. I like to have an iTunes movie file to download to keep off onto a backup hard drive, but then also have everything available for streaming as well. So this is perfect for me. And it also means a lot less ripping Blu-rays and things like that. So really great experience. Very excited, very happy that all my movies are now all together. And thanks for the show and talk to you later. Bye.
Hey, thanks, Ty. I also really like this service, if you couldn't tell by my comments earlier. And what's really cool is if you sign up and you link all of your accounts, they'll actually give you like 5 free movies. Now, unfortunately, I think 4 of them I already owned. So I did get Jason Bourne, the new Jason Bourne movie for free. And again, it shows up now in any one of my accounts, whether I'm in Amazon or I'm in iTunes, it is right there along with all of my other movies, like you mentioned. And I will just clarify on the Vudu thing. So Vudu is owned, I believe, by Walmart, and they have this disc to digital thing that you can do. So when you install the Vudu app, there's a disc to digital option. It allows you to scan the barcode on your Blu-ray discs or your DVDs, and then you can basically unlock a digital copy of that inside Vudu. But now, because Vudu is part of this Movies Anywhere, that also means it would digitally unlock that copy inside iTunes. Now, the service is not free. You actually have to do pay a small fee for those digital copies. So for Blu-rays, I think they charge $2 to convert a Blu-ray to a digital version. And for DVDs, you can pay $2 for an SD copy or $5 for an HD copy. But as Ty mentioned, it does save you having to do the ripping and conversion yourself, which can take a really long time, can be time consuming, and it may be worth it for you for just a couple bucks to be able to pay that and get that digital copy. I think it's a great option. I'm probably going to be doing it with some of my old DVD discs that I've been wanting to rebuy or repurchase. Unfortunately, I've already repurchased some of those at full price on iTunes, but now I'll be able to, at least for $5, upgrade some of my favorite movies from the SD ripped copies that I did myself, which I have in Plex and in my iTunes library, and I can now get those in HD on Vudu, and then through Movies Anywhere, get them also on iTunes. Now, it's unclear if you'll also get the 4K versions, but I'm guessing maybe you will. Don't really know. We'll have to play around and test that out a little bit, but it's really cool. I wanted to bring it up in case you hadn't seen the Movies Anywhere thing. Check it out if you're into digital movies or into movies at all on iTunes. I think it's a great service. All right, last thing that I want to talk to you about this week is a thing of the moment. I got a chance to review and play this great new game. It's a tabletop digital hybrid game called Beasts of Balance, and it is now available at your local Apple store, so you can pick up a copy there. And what this is, it's basically a connected dexterity stacking game that has this little collection element, and I'm going to explain all of this to you the best I can. It's probably best, I'll have a link to the website in the show notes at maccast.com. They've got some great videos and you can see this thing. But basically what you get is you get this little stand. It's called a plinth, and it's almost like a little digital scale. And then along with that, what you have is you have a bunch of objects. You have, of course, beasts, which are these little pieces. They're actually not too little. They're a pretty good sized piece and really good quality plastic pieces. And they're kind of geometrically shaped. Polygons, you know, they're like made out of polygons because they've got flat surfaces on the edges, but they still look like the things that they represent. So there's like a bear and an eagle and a toucan and a squid, and they're all really cool looking pieces. Like I said, really high quality. And then they also have these pieces that are called miracles and migrate pieces, which look like little arrows, and these cross pieces, and then elements, which play into the game. So there are all these different shaped pieces. And what you're basically going to do is you're going to take these and you're going to stack them on top of the plinth. But it's also a connected game. So it connects to your iPhone, your iPad, your Android device. And as you're playing the game, the pieces and things are interacting with the app. And so what you're trying to do, the basic goal of the game is to stack all of these things on top as high as you can get, or as many as you can get stacked on top of the plinth. But then also in the digital game, what you're doing is each one of the beasts that you place will go into a different zone, and they have land, water, or air. And you are trying to basically kind of keep the beasts and the world in balance. And you do that through the points. And so each one of these little objects has a little NFC chip in it, and you scan it into the plinth, and then the plinth is connected to the iPad via Bluetooth, and it will recognize the piece that you're about to add to your little tower as you're building up and trying to balance these things together. So you scan it in, and the beasts are separated into those three categories. You have two land beasts, two water beasts, and two air beasts, and when you add one, it's added to the appropriate section. And then there's small ones and large ones. The small are worth 3 points, and the larger ones are worth 6 points. And what happens is you put one in and say it's a 3-point land animal. That's fine. You get 3 points added to your total score of the game. And then when you scan in, say, another one that's maybe 6 points and it goes into the sea, what'll happen is the land animal gets jealous of the sea animal. So the sea animal's worth 6 points, adds to your three, that's 9. But then the land animal gets jealous. It gives up a point and goes down to 2. So now you have a total of 8 points. And you can then use some of the other elements, the things called element artifacts in the game, to actually kind of beef up or buff up the different animals. And you're trying to get the highest score by sort of keeping everything in balance. And there's also these things called miracles that let you that add sort of challenges to the game, which you can earn more points with. I don't want to go into all of the little bits and pieces, but basically you're just trying to get the highest score you can, build the largest stack that you can. And it's really fun and quick to play and learn. We have been having a great time with it. It is very challenging to master because the pieces are a little bit oddly shaped, and so trying to figure out how they can all fit together and stay on top of that thing. And there's a really cool element too, where if the pieces fall off, you're actually given a few moments to try and restack them. So if you can restack them quickly, what you see on the iPad is this volcano starts coming up. And if you can get them restacked before the volcano overflows, then you get to continue to play. Otherwise, the game's over and you get a score. Now, I also mentioned that there is a little bit of a collection element to the game. So in the digital side of things, when you add a new animal to the plinth, it will be added to your digital collection of animals. And I mentioned earlier that there's a thing called a cross. And what that allows you to do is it allows you to take two animals in the game and cross them together. So when you play the cross piece, it will cross one animal with another one, create an entirely new animal, put that into the environment, and then that animal goes into your collection. And there are, as you might imagine, a lot of various combinations. So another big fun part of the game is trying to figure out what happens when I cross this animal with that animal, and can I collect a new, entirely new animal to add to my animal collection inside the app. So like I said, it is a lot of fun. It's great for all ages. My kids love it. I've been playing it. You can play it solo. You can play it together. And one of the cool things about it too is because it is a digital game and it has an app associated with it, it seems to me like it has incredible potential possibilities for future expansion. As a matter of fact, they already have a couple extra beast pieces that you can buy and purchase to add to the game. And I have a feeling they're going to be adding more and more of that sort of thing over time. But also they have the ability to tweak the app and possibly come up with new challenges and new games and new artifacts and all sorts of things. So it is really cool. Like I said, very high quality. All the pieces are really great. And you can buy it now at the Apple Store or on Amazon. It's priced at $99 US. I think it's £69 in the UK. And it's just a lot of fun. So if you're looking for something unique, original, and fun for the holidays, you might give this a look. Beast of Balance is the name of the game. Beasts of Balance, and you can find it at beastsofbalance.com. And that is my thing of the moment for this week. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can find more information and details on all of their great applications by going to smilesoftware.com/maccast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, if you have comments for me, questions, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the MacCast Google Plus community. That's at google.com/plusMacCast. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.